You're listening to DG Talks, a podcast brought to you by Delta Gamma. Each month, a Delta Gamma host will speak on a different topic, covering a wide range of interests for our sisters. We look forward to engaging with you on social media about other topics you would like to hear, and we hope you enjoy this episode.
Hello, sisters. My name is Shivani Peterson. I'm an alum of the Eta Iota chapter at the University of Nevada, Reno. And I'm super excited to talk with you guys today. We're going to talk about money and hopefully give you some different viewpoints and unique strategies to kind of better ourselves financially. So I think that financial confidence in America is lacking overall. And I think it's because people don't talk about money the way they talk about other things. It's not an open, acceptable, politically correct conversation topic for happy hour or a dinner party at your friend's house. So motherhood, I think, on the whole, has gotten so much better because we've gotten more open about it. Everyone from your friends to social media influencers is talking about their experience and sharing it in a more real way. And it's made the whole thing better for us. I mean, I survived the first few years of my boys' lives relying on advice from friends and calling them to see what really works. Is it normal that I feel this way? Should I want to strangle my husband? Is that concerning, et cetera? So that improved my experience and it made it better. But people don't talk about money like that. I mean, aside from, you know, the very wealthy talking about their investments at country clubs or the guys bragging about an interest rate on a golf course, but not exactly sharing how many points they paid to get that rate. You just don't find people openly sharing what's working for them with their household budget and what's not. So in my experience as a mortgage lender, for the past 8 years, I've worked with couples, families, individuals, multi-generational situations where we were passing money down, passing money up. I've seen a lot of different scenarios. And the thing that I found is that it's not one unique strategy that works for everyone. What I found really works for most people is that they're being honest with the other people in their house, or even just honest with themselves about their finances. Being in a place of integrity with your money is truly key. So I kind of want to back up with you guys and give you some, I'll share my story since that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about being open with money. So I'll share my story on how I got to a place of financial security. So back in my DG days, I had scholarships for school and scholarships that paid for my Delta Gamma dues. But the rest kind of, I worked full time, but the rest of the fun stuff went on credit cards. So in working full time, that paid my rent. It paid for my books. But then, you know, going out to the bar or getting a dress for the dance or having my makeup done for formal, all of that kind of stuff went on credit cards. And by the time I graduated, I had somewhere between $7,000 and $10,000 of credit card debt, which is really a lot to leave college with. I was fortunate in the fact that I didn't have student loans, but that credit card debt, you know, is anxiety causing. That's a lot of money on your shoulders as a 22-year-old. In my first job, this is like 2009. So I had a job as a general manager of a small business. It was actually a salon. And I think my starting salary was about $30,000 a year, which was enough to pay rent and survive on, but not to really start tackling my credit cards. And I wanted to have some savings built up first. So for my 20s, I was in a situation where I started building savings and it was kind of like a false sense of security because I still had credit card debt. And this is a question that I often get from friends and from clients. Should I use my savings to pay off my debts or should I keep savings on hand? And what I learned myself in my 20s is that you really are just kidding yourself, feeling good about having money in a savings account, whether it's a couple $100s or a couple $1,000s, if you're paying interest on other debts. So credit card debts, student loans, an auto loan. Really, if you have any debt outside of a mortgage, it should be attacked aggressively to get rid of it. And I think that a lot of people want to pay that off last. They want to pretend it's not there. And it's not a good strategy in the long run. So I advise clients that they should have a little bit of savings, the average American, and hopefully you guys will be shocked to hear this, but the average American cannot afford a $500 emergency, which I find to be completely unacceptable. I mean, you never know what challenge is right around the corner. So I recommend that you have somewhere between 3 and 6 months living expenses saved up for a worst case scenario. And once you've got that little nest egg, you need to be aggressively paying off other debt, credit cards, student loans. If you have a home equity line of credit, if you're already a homeowner, anything besides your mortgage should be attacked. Now, once you've paid off your other debts and you have that little bit of emergency savings, then maybe I'm sure there's sisters listening from all different walks of life right now, and all different stages of their life. Maybe you start saving up for your down payment for your home. Maybe you start contributing more to your retirement. Right now, as I'm recording this, it's early June 2020. And it's been an interesting few months, to say the least. But the one thing that we've really learned, and that I hope everyone can take away from this year so far, is that you never know what challenge is around the corner. Heading into this year, the economy was bustling. People were doing great. There was so much optimism. Who would have thought that a pandemic would come and smack us upside the heads and turn our economy upside down? Now we have mass unemployment. People are struggling and they weren't prepared. The thing about our country is that we tend to live to the max of what we can afford without saving. So when you tell people they should have an emergency savings and they should limit their debts, they usually just don't want to hear that advice because it's not fun. It's not sexy. The better thing to do is to buy the fanciest car and push yourself to the limits of what you can afford. We start making more money. We say we're going to save more, but in reality, our life just gets more expensive. So this year, a lot of people are coming to terms with the fact that they need a backup strategy. And I think you can put that together in a couple different ways. Passive income is a huge, huge, huge benefit. And it doesn't have to be that you have a rental property, or it doesn't have to be something huge, intangible, a big challenge you don't think is really realistic for you. Passive income can start not so passive. It can start as a side hustle. Maybe there's something you can do on the side to earn some extra money that you pretend you're not really earning. You put it straight into savings or you put it straight towards your credit card. That provides you reassurance. Having that reassurance can change your whole outlook on life. It can stop you from living in fear. It can limit your anxiety. It can take you out of bad situations because you have something to fall back on. The next thing that I think is really important for people to focus on, aside from having passive income and aside from having emergency savings, is truly evaluating their housing expense. So I work in the mortgage industry. I'm in the real estate business. And a lot of people have asked me, well, should we buy a home now? I mean, the country's at the beginning of a recession. Home prices haven't really gone down. And I'm not sure where it's safe to put my money. The stock market doesn't feel a very safe place to invest. But I also don't know if I should put it into real estate. So if you're renting right now, it never makes sense to keep renting. You should be paying your own mortgage. You should be using a home as your forced savings account. Forced savings account. What does that mean? Why would your house be a forced savings account? So when you're paying rent, you guys know that you're just paying your landlord. They get to collect that money. They may have a mortgage that they're paying off using your money. They may not have a mortgage. They may just be profiting from your rent. But regardless, you're not putting money in a hole, I would say. I think that's a bit harsh when people say that about renting, but you aren't building anything for yourself. That much is clear. When you buy a home, every month, part of your payment, part of your housing expense, that line item on your budget that you really can't get rid of, is going towards your principal. When you pay down the principal of your loan, you own a little bit more of your house. It's called your equity. So you're building your equity in your home. That equity can be tapped into in an emergency. That equity is being built up so that when you sell the home, you have profit. That equity is your forced savings account. So if you're renting right now, I think it's excellent to sit down, meet with a mortgage advisor, meet with your financial planner, and put together a strategy so that you can get into a position to buy in the near future. Well, when is the best time to buy? This is another question I get all the time. So you can't time the market. You don't have control over it. You never know when some external factor, like a pandemic, is going to come and turn the market upside down. You can't time home values and prices. You can only control your own finances. So what I tell people is the right time to buy is when it's the right time for you, when it makes sense for you financially. So if you can get yourself into a position to buy, then it's the right time to buy. It's the right time to stop paying rent. Today, tomorrow, yesterday was the right time to stop paying rent. When you own your home, you have that forced savings account, you're building equity, you're paying yourself. And that's an amazing strategy. So now, if you're listening to this and you're a little bit past that point and you are thinking, I already own my home, how can you give me some value, Shivani, from listening to this podcast? So the mortgage business I found is very intimidating to the consumer. They're not really sure how they should go about properly applying for a mortgage or being smart about getting financing because there's a lot of conflicting information out there about finances in general, but specifically about mortgages. The main advice you get is shop around, look for the best interest rate, negotiate hard on interest rate. That's the best thing you can do. And I think that advice is really misleading. There's better questions you can ask of a mortgage lender when you're interviewing them to make sure that you end up in the right hands and in the best possible financing strategy for you. And of course, with the lowest interest rate. So let me share some insight from the industry with you guys so you can see how things work and hopefully have a better understanding. When you go to apply for a mortgage, depending on whether you go to a big bank, a direct lender, or a broker, there's a difference in what you're going to get as a result. So big banks like Chase, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, they retain their loans, meaning they're going to process the loan for you. You're also going to make your payments on that loan to them. Because of that, because they only have their own loans to offer you, they're limited to their own interest rates. The rest of the lending sphere is working to make all those banks compete. So I'm sure you guys have seen that LendingTree commercial where it says, make the banks compete for you. So what that's suggesting is that you work with a direct lender or a broker who goes out with your exact profile as a borrower and says, which bank wants this loan? And they make them all compete, all of them. Lots of names you never even hear of in the mainstream market who buy loans in the secondary market. And we see who has the best possible pricing for you that day. So direct lenders and brokers do that. Brokers charge you a third-party fee to go out and find that best rate for you, to shop your loan around, because they don't actually do the loan themselves. Direct lenders process, underwrite, fund your loan in-house, so you don't have to pay a third party to go out and find that best rate for you. So if you're working with a direct lender, overall, you're probably in the best situation. That's a great question to ask when you're starting to shop around for a mortgage lender. What kind of bank are you with? Are you a broker? Are you a direct lender? Do you retain your own loans? How are you paid? So direct lenders get paid when they sell your loan to whichever bank they locked it who had the best pricing. That means they don't have to charge you the money up front. They can make it on the back end when they sell it. Brokers are the same. They get compensated by the bank they're sending your loan to, which is good for you because you don't have to pay a lot up front. Now, you also want to ask a lender, who's on your team? How do you get the loans done? And how do you get paid? So lenders can get compensated and they can compensate their team by building that into your interest rate. You want to know if that's happening or not because it probably means that you could get a better rate elsewhere. And then lastly, a question I would ask them is, do you have reviews online that I could read? Because you not knowing all of the mortgage products out there is not something you should take the time to learn. If you were to educate yourself on all the mortgage and underwriting guidelines, and they're ever changing, you would lose your mind. It's just not a good use of your time or effort. So check out a lender's reviews so that you can see what has other people's experiences with them been like. You can look on Zillow for these. You can look on Facebook. There's social survey. There's a lot of different platforms. Ask the lender where you could go to read about previous clients' experience with them. So for everyone out there who owns a home right now, this information might be helpful to you in thinking about refinancing, because for the next year or so, we're probably going to be in an excellent refinance window. Right now, rates are historically low. Fannie and Freddie have released information on their predictions for rates, and they say that we see the bottom of those towards the end of 2020, early 2021. So knowing about how to shop for a mortgage lender or mortgage rate could be good and useful information for you guys over the next year. Who should refinance and who shouldn't? The best way to know if it really makes sense for you, besides a shiny interest rate, is to look at your net savings over the next 5 and 15 years. So ask the lender to put that together for you. Ask them to show you not just your monthly savings, but which is going to show you, which loan product is going to show you the best benefit over the next 5 and 15 years after taking into account all costs associated with refinancing. Look for your net savings. Coming back around to we've talked about if you are thinking about buying, if you're still renting, what you should do. We've talked about if you own your home, how to go about shopping for a mortgage properly. Now, what about if you're thinking about how do I time a move up or my next purchase or maybe stepping into the investment property sphere? So the problem we're seeing right now is inventory. Going into this year, it was very competitive for buyers. There was not enough inventory nationwide for the amount of people who want to buy homes. It's a supply and demand problem. Well, how is this COVID-19 crisis and resulting recession going to impact that? So far, what we've seen, and I'm only going to talk about what we've seen so far because I don't have a crystal ball, but we've seen the April numbers come out, and we saw that the median home price increased yet again, which is so strange, right? People are losing their jobs. The economy's hurting. How are home prices going up? Well, let's go back to that supply and demand problem I talked about. There weren't enough homes for everyone who wanted to buy them before. Yes, some buyers have left the market because they don't have jobs or they had to use up some of their emergency savings during quarantine. Some buyers have definitely left the market or at least feeling apprehensive about their plans to buy this year. The problem was, sellers left the market faster. So if you're thinking, imagine that you're a seller, you want to list your home for sale, either move on to a bigger home this year or downsize or move to a different city. Do you feel good about putting your home on the market when buyers have been under shelter in place orders? Are you feeling like you're really going to get your property the best exposure if people can't come see it in person? No, you're thinking, no, I should not list my home right now. So sellers, there was less sellers putting their homes on the market right away. That didn't help inventory. We just saw the numbers for April come out for housing starts. They're down 30%. Housing starts means builders who are building new inventory to hit the market. They pumped the brakes on that plan because they're not sure how this is all going to play out. Well, that squeezed inventory even more. So the problem is, yes, we have less buyers, but we have way less inventory, and the supply and demand problem got even worse. Here in Reno, where I am, we have a huge supply and demand problem. And in the last couple weeks, as the shelter in place orders have begun to be lifted and buyers are getting back onto their plans of buying this year, I have had so many and multiple offer situations where the competition is just really, really tight. Fannie and Freddie also released a prediction that 2020 will see the housing market slow a little bit, for a multitude of reasons, some of which are obvious, some of which relate to these inventory problems, but that by 2021, it'll go back to being just as heated as it was in 2019. And I'm already feeling that heat from just having boots on the ground and buyers who are getting outbid. So I would predict that home values are going to continue to hold strong and housing will be a good place to invest for the coming years. A lot of analysts are actually predicting that housing could be what leads us out of this recession. So to come back to sharing my own story of how I started to achieve financial independence and be financially secure, after a few years managing a small business, I felt like, I feel like I've kind of hit the ceiling here. I want to go try something new. So I had done that. I had worked in the salon industry for about 8 years when I decided to come into mortgage lending. And the amazing thing about this industry is, one, it taught me a lot about managing money, different strategies that work for different households, how to budget. But like I said at the beginning of when I started talking, it taught me a lot about being in a place of integrity and being honest with yourself so that you can be honest with the other people in your life about where you really stand financially. You guys probably notice all the time that you'll see people and the decisions they're making with their money and you think, how do they afford that? Well, I can tell you from looking at a lot of people's finances, a lot of people can't afford what they're doing. They just keep doing it anyways. Then they get to a place in life where something like a pandemic happens or a recession or even just retirement comes along. It sneaks up on them and then they're pushed back down, knocked off their feet and they land on their bum. I think the best ways to avoid that are that you start building up savings. We've talked about this, right? That you own your home, so you have another forced savings account. But how do you be honest with yourself about your money? One, don't compare. Do not compare what works for you with anybody else. Because like I just pointed out, you don't know that anybody else can really afford what they're doing. So it doesn't matter. What matters is what you can afford. A lot of us don't know exactly what it costs us to be alive, to function, to live and pay all our bills on a monthly basis. If you've not already done this, sit down, grab an Excel spreadsheet, list out every single thing you pay for, from groceries to gas, to your housing expense, to your student loan payments, all of it. You need to know exactly where you stand. Then put in your income and compare it with that number. Is there enough for flexible spending? And then know exactly what your flexible spending budget is. I do think there's a lot to be said that you can only cut expenses so much before you need to start earning more. And this exercise might help you realize, I make enough money to sustain the type of lifestyle I want, or I don't, and I need to start earning more, or I spend some money on some really stupid stuff because I don't know if I'm allowed to cuss on this podcast. So the experience could be really helpful for you and beginning to being on the experiment exercise, I should say, could be really helpful for you and being honest with yourself about where you really stand and knowing where your money goes. Because just knowing is a lot of empowerment in itself. Because if something happens, things don't go well, you know exactly where to cut, but you also know exactly what you're working towards and what you're building. So that's something that once I got into this industry, I started doing. I started being really honest with myself about my money, and I started working harder to make more money. This is a huge opportunity and a huge key towards financial success. A lot of the people that I admire and a lot of people that I look up to financially, they focus on making more money. Not just the hours you work and the take-home pay, but ways to make your money work harder for you. So that's my next goal in life. And once I've accomplished more streams of compounding money, more passive income streams, I'll definitely be back to share it with all my sisters, because as women, I think that we can live much, much better lives when we feel good about our finances. That doesn't mean you have to be on your own. That doesn't mean you have to have separate finances from your husband. That doesn't mean that you have to do it my way or her way or this way or that way. It means that you find the way that works best for you, because you'd be amazed at the way it changes your outlook on life, the way it makes you feel independent, strong, confident. That can mean something different for every single one of you listening, but you should feel all those things when it comes to your money. And if you don't, start building your financial team to get there. You should have a mortgage lender that you can work with. You should have a financial advisor that you talk to regularly. And you should have someone helping you with your taxes to make sure you're optimizing that and reducing your tax burden as much as possible. So I hope that this information for you guys was helpful today. I hope you got value from it. You can follow me on Instagram. I share a lot of financial advice there. You can find me on Facebook. You can reach out to me. I'd love to hear your opinions. I'd love to have an intellectual conversation with you. I'd love to debate with you. I think that the more we talk about money, the better it's going to get for everyone. So thanks for tuning in.
Thank you for listening to this episode of DG Talks. Be sure to connect with us on Facebook at Delta Gamma.